This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What's changed in your home state over the past 80 years, and what hasn't? What's the essence of its character, its distinction, its identity? In 1922, The Nation magazine published an eclectic snapshot of these United States, 49 essays, one for each state then in the Union, plus Washington, D.C., writers as distinguished and diverse as Willa Cather, Theodore Dreiser and Sinclair Lewis were asked for their observations about Nebraska, Indiana, and Minnesota. 80 years later, The Nation invited a similar group to do the same. In a few minutes, we'll talk with Gerald Early, Missouri, Luke Sant, New Jersey, Sherman Alexie, Washington, and Annie Prue, Wyoming. And we're giving you the same assignment. Call and tell us about the people, the topography, the diners, or whatever it is that you think defines your state. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Literary critic and author John Leonard edited and wrote the introduction for These United States. He joins us now by phone from his home in New York City. And John, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for having me.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving right back.
In 1922, World War I was over. Westward expansion was slowing. The nation changing. Ernest Gruening wrote in the introduction of the original These United States that we need a reevaluation of our national heritage. Are we at a similar crossroads now, do you think?
Well, I would hate to make it sound as though this were as overdetermined as that that would make it appear. We in and around the nation have wanted to put out a new version of that book for quite a few years, and it just never got off the ground until now, and I'm not sure exactly why. But it could be certainly when I undertook to draw up a wish list of writers that I wanted to hear from about how they felt about their hometowns and their home states and their home regions. My personal feeling was that I live in New York. I've lived in New York for far too long. My professional life is reviewing books, reviewing movies, and reviewing television programs. And I live in a floating world. I don't know anything, and I'm sort of detached. My senses are detached. And I do not believe that sitcoms on television, that Clear Channel Radio, that Fox News, that these people are telling me the truth about my country. I simply don't believe it. So I went and asked a whole bunch of other people what was going on in their part of the world, and what we got back was diverse enough to make me feel, my God, it is still my country after all.
Is there a common theme in all these different essays that you detect?
No, there isn't a common theme. There is a sense that every region is more complicated than the outside world thinks it is, and more complicated than the people who are living there often think it is. There is a nostalgia for a better world, but a skepticism that it actually ever existed or that we're just dreaming it. We've got well over 50 essays. We have two essays from California, three from New York. I can't generalize that they all come out anywhere except a strong sense that, especially after 9/11, people are thinking about themselves. They're thinking about their work. They're thinking about their environment. They're thinking about their politics. They may not be thinking what I would prefer them to think, or you would prefer them to think, or George Bush would prefer them to think, but when the towers went down, some introspection occurred, and that comes out in odd notes throughout. But again, what we sought was diversity, even in form. I didn't ask for essays of any particular outline. It didn't have to go to the past. It didn't have to be economic or social. We asked a lot of novelists, so we got a lot of sensibility. So what we got was a diversity that makes it impossible to generalize for you as to what we got. We got different people saying different things, but all of it. How to put this without making it sound sappy? All of it heartfelt. There's something grainy about each of the essays that appeals to me, as though nobody took this lightly. Why should they? They were being asked something impossible. Give me 2,500 words on your state. Instead, they said, how do I bounce off this? And therefore, we got some odd spins and everything, but what we got felt real.
It's interesting you talk about diversity in this age of incessant media, and you spoke to that a few minutes ago, the internet, cable television, and franchising. It seems that this is becoming a more homogenous place. There's a Starbucks and Applebee's almost everywhere.
Yeah, and it's hard to see how that can be in any way reversible. At least I can't see it from where I sit. Which is why I went outside. But this is what a commercial culture wants. Of course, it wants an homogenous group out there responding, because it wants us to be commodified, and it wants to buy and sell. This is inevitable, and yet we do know that things feel different, and it just. Is how do you get that? I mean, I sit here as a TV critic. I have about 1,000 cable channels on my digital dial. I can watch the two country music stations. Does this really tell me what's going on in Memphis? Does it tell me what's going on in the South? Does Toby Keith singing about "I Love This Bar" with the Confederate flag in the background and the pickup truck parked outside? Is this something that he wrote? After Howard Dean said what he said, I mean, I begin to feel that I'm living in a bunch of images instead of what's going on in the real world. And yet, this is the logic of the economy. This is the logic of the politics. This is the logic of the culture. Is that and it has been working that way ever since, say, Howard Johnson's. When Howard Johnson's built his ice cream parlors with the flaming sunset orange roof, you know, it's scattered in the South and West, you always knew exactly what you were going to get. And this was followed basically by the development of the motel culture, and motels were not designed especially to distinguish between themselves or among themselves. They were designed to give you a repeatable, predictable environment and economy to stop.
Howard Johnson's 28 flavors all the same.
Yeah. And it was... And frankly, when I was in doubt in some place I'd never been before, and I saw Howard Johnson's, well, I knew I could get what I could get, not just the ice cream, but I could get a hamburger, and I could get a place to sleep. So we're all susceptible. We all want comfort. We all want repetition. We certainly develop routines in our lives. And yet, we also know when we sit here that we can't stay forever at the television set, or we can't walk around forever with the Walkman on. Much as I'm annoyed by people who sit next to me on the crosstown bus and talking to their cell phones over and over again, I've decided that I prefer it to people who are listening to Walkmans who were not reacting at all to anybody around them and weren't communicating to any other human being whatsoever. So I look for ways to improve my morale, and certainly these writers out there reporting back from the edges of what they were feeling and seeing did improve my morale.
Well, John, thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, I wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and I hope everything goes well with the program.
Thanks very much. Bye. John Leonard reviews books for The Nation and for Harper's. He's also the editor of These United States. He joined us by phone from his home in New York. And we'd like your nominees, your definitions of what makes your home state unique. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Chad, who's in Syracuse, New York.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I'm originally from the New York City area, and I live in Syracuse now. And what's very interesting is that people usually associate the state of New York with New York City. And there's so much to New York besides New York City, such as our hills, our apple growing, our farming, that people know New York, they use Manhattan. In addition to that, we're a very strong union state. Which people tend to forget about how strong and prevalent our unions are in New York State, and just constantly focus on the city.
Well, you will be pleased then to hear that in These United States, there are, as John Leonard mentioned, three essays on New York, one on New York City, one on Long Island, and one on that vast area that everybody from New York City calls upstate.
That's it.
Well, Chad, thanks very much, and have a happy Thanksgiving there in Syracuse, New York.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Let's go to Michael, and Michael's with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Michael.
Yes. You know, I live in the Twin Cities metro area of Minnesota, and that's really the only major metropolitan area in our state. But, you know, and I travel around the state quite a bit, too. But the thing I've most seen change since I've lived in the state is that quite a bit of diversity has started to appear in the state. That is to say, a lot of Hmong refugees have settled in St. Paul, especially,
mm-hmm.
and we have a lot more Hispanics. So there's a lot of issues we're dealing with languages and assimilating those cultures into our culture. But one of the things I'm proud of is in our state, and especially the metro area, is there is still a sense of small-town America, even in the metro area. I'm sitting in a neighborhood right now in my car that's probably a mile from downtown, and it still has that neighborhood feel, the beautiful old Victorian houses, and the children are, in fact, there's kids walking in front of me right now with their sleds. And as you go throughout the state, there still is that Lake Wobegon feel, if you will, to the state, and it really is that way in the state.
That mention of the sled, Minnesota received the first significant snowfall of the year, quite a bit of it, too.
Yeah, I think we got 6 or 7 inches. It's now turning into a nice slush.
Ah, well, makes it just like Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Okay. Michael, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. And happy Thanksgiving to you.
You too.
Joining us now by phone from his home in St. Louis, Missouri, is Gerald Early. He wrote the essay on Missouri in These United States. It's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're going to hear a portion now of the original These United States essay on Missouri. This is what Manly O. Hudson had to say some 80 years ago about the Show Me State.
As to our politics, they don't much matter. We like the game. A few men, and latterly women, play it and are admired. A few more spectate. But Missouri was never a sovereign, independent state, and we look upon our state government as merely a local division under a government which has its seat in far-off Washington.
Gerald Early, one of the things you write about in your essay is that Missouri is the home of John Ashcroft and Dick Gephardt. Is Washington still a far-off seat, or does it mean something more to these gentlemen from your state?
I don't think it's such a far-off place anymore, Washington is. We have politicians who have quite large ambitions and have played large on the national stage. And I opened the essay by talking about Senator Danforth, and I did that in talking about some of the prominent conservative politicians who have come from Missouri and their effect nationally. To show, in effect, that Missouri, at least in recent years, insofar as both conservative and liberal politics, is far from being a provincial state. They've had some people who've been players.
Including, as you mentioned, Senator John Danforth, who was a leading figure in the Republican Party for some time, though lost his seat and then following the Clarence Thomas affair.
Well, he stepped down from his seat, actually. There was talk that he stepped down from the seat because he was afraid of a backlash as a result of his involvement with the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. But he stepped down, and as a result, that really opened the door for John Ashcroft to become senator from the state, which is what happened.
And he later lost a senatorial election to a dead man in curious circumstances, and that opened the possibilities for him to become the Attorney General of the United States. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Gerald Early about the state of Missouri, baseball, jazz, and other stuff. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the 1920s, The Nation published a series of essays about each of the American states called These United States. The project has been redone, and we're speaking with author. Gerald Early, who's a professor of English and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis, about his state of Missouri. And before the break, Gerald Early, we mentioned baseball. And people tend to forget in this era of continental baseball that for many, many years, St. Louis in Missouri was both the most westerly and the most southern outpost for Major League Baseball.
Yes, I mean, it's that is something that people do forget. That it's one of the reasons why the city of St. Louis is called the Gateway to the West, because before air travel made it possible to have teams on the West Coast, St. Louis was as far west and south as you got. And so the city and Missouri itself for a long time was kind of considered a sort of the last outpost before you got before you went through a whole bunch of states to get you to California.
You also write about its importance as you know, its identity. It's not quite a southern state. It's not quite a western state anymore. And a border state was its definition of going back to the Civil War days.
Yes, Missouri has always had an identity problem. It's not really a southern state. People here do not have a southern drawl. The state was divided during the Civil War, and sort of it had two governments, and one of them was the Union government, and one was a Confederacy government. It was it had slavery, but it also had this very strong German population, which was very, very strongly anti-slavery. It has never really identified with the South other than having slavery and being part of the Confederacy, or supposedly part of the Confederacy during the Civil War. It has mostly seen itself in competition with the city of Chicago, and it's a competition that unfortunately, well, the city of St. Louis saw itself in competition with Chicago, and it's something that it's lost. It's lost that competition, and the state of Missouri itself has always seen itself in relation to largely Illinois, and largely seeing itself in competing against the state of Illinois.
Well, before all the Cubs and Cardinals fans call in, that rivalry is very much still alive.
Oh, man, this past year, it was very intense. I mean, it was probably the most intense it's been in a long time, because the Cubs were
good for once.
Yeah, they were good for once, and better than the St. Louis Cardinals and this year. But the rivalry between St. Louis and Chicago is very much emblematic of the rivalry between Missouri and Illinois.
Gerald Early, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Gerald Early, as we mentioned, a professor of English and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, wrote the Missouri entry for These United States, and he was with us from his home in St. Louis. Let's get a call now from Ken, who's on the line in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Well, hi there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Very well. So what is it that defines Arizona, do you think?
For me, it's being at home, looking out in the backyard, seeing my pool full of water in the desert when we've only had 3 or 4 inches of rain off here. And around the pool, I have citrus trees, roses, carnations in bloom. If I look off to the west, I can see the buttes with holes and caves in them, red sandstone. And then off to the east, I can see snow-capped peaks with forests. In March, I can go to a Cubs training game in Mesa, go see the San Francisco Giants down the street, or the California A's, and I just love it. It's just great. It's a wonderful place. It's a new state. I live in a relatively old home. It was built in 1958. I moved here from Massachusetts, and 1958 would have been a brand new home. So that's what makes Arizona different for me, and I just love it.
Ken, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And it's not quite a Massachusetts Thanksgiving, but I'm sure you'll enjoy it tomorrow.
Thank you, and you do the same.
Very well. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's try now Dahl, who's with us from Lula, Mississippi.
That's right.
And you're on the air, Dahl. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that Mississippi is the best of the 50 states, because of all the 50 states, Mississippi's made the most progress in the last 30 years toward the ideals of the American people, such as examining your soul, trying to redeem yourself for your past eras and sins like slavery, racism. I lived in New York City 8 years and now live in San Francisco. And it's sort of the alpha and omega of the United States, and I found that prejudice is a worldwide dilemma. But I feel like people in Mississippi are the best people on earth because they admit their sinful natures, myself included. And besides that, Mississippi has the best of everything, like best athletes. Remember Charlie Conley from the 50s, the New York Giants?
I remember him well.
And remember, we have the best food. We have the best weather. We have the best soil. And we have the best music, art, writers, everything. So, but please don't move there, but because we have enough people. That's the only thing about Mississippians. They sort of want to keep the state to themselves.
Dahl, thanks very much, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
And joining us now is novelist, filmmaker, and Washington State resident, Sherman Alexie. He wrote the Washington Entry. He's with us from his office in Seattle, and welcome to Talk of the Nation. Good to have you back.
Oh, thank you. It's always good to be here.
One of the things that's interesting is we were talking to somebody from Syracuse, New York, earlier, and there are three essays on New York, Long Island, New York City, and upstate. In your essay on Washington, you really write about three different areas in that state as well.
Yeah, two different areas of Washington and Idaho. One of the arguments in my essay is that northern Idaho and eastern Washington should secede and form their own state called David Thompson, named after, an explorer who did a lot more for the Pacific Northwest than Lewis and Clark ever did. So I guess the idea was that these sort of arbitrary government boundaries don't really accurately reflect the cultural and political nature of Washington State.
Seattle, described by many of the other people in the state, you write as the People's Republic of Seattle.
People's Republic of Seattle, because we tend to vote for Democrats, and the residents of Seattle refer to everybody else in the state as trailer park Nazis because they tend to vote Republican. So it's a binary state, certainly, Seattle and everywhere else.
You describe it at one point as a hungry and angry state. Why so?
It was founded on violence, of course, through colonialism, and it's still to this day one of the more rural, one of the more gun-owning NRA, white supremacist, secret witness relocation, white separatist, methamphetamine, pot-smoking, pot-growing, draft-dodging hermit states in the country. Much of it is still very isolated and vastly underdeveloped, so I think a lot of the more eccentric people in the country end up in eastern Washington. So I think a lot of that sort of rugged, violent individualism is still very strong here.
Sherman Alexie, in his essay, describes the highly imperfect, woefully violent, and utterly magical place known as the USA, of which the state of Washington is a very small, imperfect, violent, and magical part. You also title your essay Coyote's Unauthorized Guide to Washington State. Tell us a little bit about Coyote.
Well, I knew I was likely to be the only Native American to write in this anthology. I'm generally the only Native American to appear in any anthology I'm in. So I thought it was important to understand that what is called the United States existed as something else entirely long before it was the United States. And Coyote is a mythical figure in a lot of tribal cultures, my own specifically, Spokane. He's a trickster figure, sort of a joker, but he's also a god figure and a creator figure. So Coyote is a random, capricious god, and so I used him as a way to talk about the way in which colonialism formed Washington State, and that, colonialism and Coyote go hand in hand.
And at the end of the day, the Indian experience over the many thousands of years there in what is now Washington State ends, at least it doesn't end, but it presents itself now with Indians running big gambling casinos.
Well, one of the most ironic and wonderful casinos in the country, and I'm ambivalent about Indian casinos, but I love the humor of them, is the Kalispells run a casino that's about 3 miles from Fairchild Air Force Base. So you'll walk into the casino, and you'll see all these Indians dealing cards to military men and everybody getting along. So obviously something is happening positively in casinos. White soldiers and Indian warriors are playing cards instead of shooting at each other. So I guess that's progress.
Sherman Alexie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And do you celebrate Thanksgiving, by the way?
Sure. We thank God that Indians saved the white folks who, you know, ended up giving birth to Bruce Springsteen. So tomorrow I give thanks for Bruce Springsteen.
Well, it's appropriate because we're going to be going next to New Jersey. What do you know about that state, by the way?
I know Newark Airport.
Well, it's certainly one of the great cultural landmarks of the state.
So, you know, most of what I know about the world are airports.
Sherman Alexie is the author of Smoke Signals and 10 Little Indians. He wrote the Washington essay for These United States, and he was with us from his office in Seattle. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get another caller in, and we'll try Clark. And Clark is with us from New Orleans.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Clark.
Thanksgiving to you and all your listeners.
Thank you.
I hope you can hear me well. I'm actually driving through Alabama, but on my way home to New Orleans for Thanksgiving.
And what is it that distinguishes Louisiana, or do you call New Orleans a separate state?
I definitely think so. It's quite different. I think most of the rest of the country thinks of Bourbon Street and thinks of the history of this of the state or the history of the city. I'll disavow everything about Bourbon Street, but the history, I think we're really reclaiming that. And the city's, doing a fantastic job of embracing that and helping that to grow.
And what do you think defines it? Again, we think of New Orleans, we think of jazz and Bourbon Street, as you mentioned. We think of a place that's shortly, seemingly, going to be inundated by the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, there is the coastal erosion, and I'd like to think that we're catching up with that. The Corps of Engineers seems to have some things going on that are going to help reclaim some of our wetlands. But at the same time, there's a lot of people coming in and reclaiming our old homes in the old parts of town that have been increasingly abandoned over the years. And more people are moving in and restoring these homes with a real sense of history and a sense of that you walk down the street and that the city really is a living museum. In the same way, the jazz is really being reclaimed also, that if you went to New Orleans only 15 years ago, you'd find only one or two bands playing in the streets and having second lines up and down the street, whereas today you'll find 18, 20 bands playing, and any weekend you can go to town and find a second line parade rolling through the city.
Well, Clark, you drive carefully, and we hope you have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. You too.
Bye-bye. Joining us now by phone from Stone Ridge, New York, is writer Luke Sant. He wrote the piece on New Jersey in These United States. Good of you to be with us today.
Hi.
And was I being unfair when I described Newark Airport as a major cultural landmark in the state of New Jersey?
I guess you could say that.
In the 1923 version of These United States, Edmund Wilson Jr. wrote this.
The chances are that you merely pass through on your way to Pennsylvania or the South, and that New Jersey seems to you essentially a region that one traverses to go between New York and Philadelphia. It has the look of a dreary dumping ground for odds and ends not wanted in the cities, a scrap heap of ignoble manufactures and uninteresting amusements that manages to cheapen even the silence of its southern pines. And in this first unflattering impression, you would not be far wrong.
That from Edmund Wilson Jr.'s essay on New Jersey in the 1923 version of These United States. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Luke Sant, has New Jersey changed a lot over the past 80 years?
Well, it's gotten more so. That's the problem. I was a little surprised to read Edmund Wilson's contribution to the earlier anthology, too, because I sort of imagined that the problem with New Jersey was rampant suburbanization and that it did have a golden age, and perhaps it did, but it was sometime before the 1920s. I had the experience of growing up in the last suburban town on the edge of the countryside. And now, of course, this was in the late 60s, early 70s. Now the countryside is 100 miles further west. And it's just one undifferentiated suburb. But what Wilson writes about is sounds like more or less the same thing, lo these many years ago.
I grew up in the first suburb on the border of the Palisades, so I guess we have something in common there. And I remember a great line that Wilfred Sheed once wrote about the state in a book, a wonderful novel called The Hack. He said, "What the rest of the country is suffering from is creeping New Jersey."
Yep, that sounds about right.
New Jersey, you say, not such a physical place, but really a state of mind.
That's correct.
What characterizes that state of mind?
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is that so many cliches are true. I mean, having not lived in New Jersey in a while now, but having had occasion to go there a lot in fairly recent years, I noticed that, you know, drivers drive differently in New Jersey. They weave through traffic a lot more. They have to get ahead of you in a way that doesn't quite obtain in surrounding states just as much.
So all those jokes about the Jersey driver, they're not canards?
There's something to them. Yeah, I hate to contribute to cliches, but there's something to them. And just on the level of having to have bigger houses, more gadgetry, all that kind of business. It seems that New Jersey is a pioneer among the states.
You write, New Jersey is a laboratory for testing upgrades and streamlinings of middle-class life. The success of these innovations has ensured their application around the country and in the more prosperous countries in the rest of the world. It is thus possible to see the spirit of New Jersey in a great many places as you travel, including Newark Airport.
Yeah.
Yet there are some places in New Jersey that are distinct, and you do think of, and in some ways not positively distinct, but of the Pine Barrens and not far away, Atlantic City.
Right. Yeah, the Pine Barrens are unique. The Pine Barrens are another world, and they really have not changed terribly much in the last couple of centuries, by all accounts. It's a group of people that have been there since about the 18th century and have rarely been immigrated into and have their own culture, and the topography is singular as well. I mean, it is, as the name goes, Pine Barrens. It's one of the few places in New Jersey that will never become suburbanized because the landscape just won't accept it. And then Atlantic City, well, Atlantic City has always had this kind of semi-offshore status. It's sort of part of the state and sort of not at the same time. And it's you know, popular mecca, and the way it's changed in the last 50 years is that there's more and more urban misery on the edge of it.
Luke Sant, you now live out of state. Do you miss New Jersey at all?
Not particularly.
Luke Sant,
sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I do miss the New Jersey I grew up in. The New Jersey these days, the town that I grew up in is, it's sort of recognizable, but it's got about 14 times as many people, and nobody I know can afford to live there anymore, so it's different in substance.
Luke Sant, thank you very much for being with us today. Luke Sant is a writer. He wrote about New Jersey in the book These United States, and he was with us from his home, which is now in Stone Ridge, New York. We'll be back with more on These United States after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Coming up in a few minutes, the capture of the wife and daughter of the second most wanted man in Iraq. But we're going to continue our conversation about These United States, a book of essays by a bunch of distinguished authors about their home states. And we're taking more of your calls and emails, TOTN at NPR.org, 800-989-8255. And Richard Alpert from Summit, New Jersey, has a different view of that state than we heard from Luke Sant. I moved to New Jersey for work-related reasons several years ago. He wrote, I was surprised to learn a well-guarded secret. New Jersey is really cool. Most people's view of the state is the turnpike and refineries near Newark Airport. Most of the state is beautiful, with rolling hills in the west, a long and relaxing coastline, small towns, and many, many fascinating cultural assets, much farmland, comfortable suburbs, and deserted pine barrens. People indeed pass through, seeing only highways and turnpikes. New Jersey has a secret, he writes. New Jersey is a secret. I gather, from the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, though it might have been. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line and go with Bill. And Bill's with us from San Francisco in California.
Hi, how's it going, Neil?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, see, I grew up in Reno. I live in San Francisco now, but in Reno, Nevada. And so I think I'm really kind of sensitive to these stereotypes that people have about different regions in the country. I lived in England for a little bit, and I lived in Illinois, and when you tell someone where you're from, they associate you with the place that that you come from. And Nevada, of course, has a lot of stereotypes as far as gaming and legalized prostitution and a place where the nation can dump their nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain. But there's a lot that, you know, that you don't hear about, like, you know, Lake Tahoe, gorgeous Lake Tahoe, and you have the Ruby Mountains on the eastern part of the state, and you have forests of Joshua trees, and you also have two of the best economies in the entire United States, Reno and Las Vegas, which are growing substantially. Of course, Las Vegas has more to do with gaming, but in Reno, because of the Indian casinos and stuff like that, the gaming industry isn't driving as much, but we're bringing in a lot more companies from California who are trying to escape the heavy tax burdens. So, you know, Nevada is one of these states that has all these stereotypes that it tries to kind of escape from.
Okay, well, when do you plan to head back to Nevada?
Well, for Thanksgiving.
Well, drive
tomorrow.
You driving?
Yeah, it's only about 3 hours from here.
So be careful, will you?
Thank you.
And have a great holiday.
Thank you very much, Neil.
And joining us now from Nevada's neighboring state of Wyoming is Annie Prue. She's the author of many novels, including The Shipping News and That Old Ace in the Hole. And it's very good of you to join us today.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Wyoming is on its license plates at least known as the Cowboy State, and that's the first image that you write about when you discuss the state of Wyoming.
It's also the first image that people crossing into Wyoming see. The state has put up signs that duplicate that license plate picture at every major road entering the state, and on that license plate is a bucking bronco, presumably the famous steamboat from early in the last century. It was renowned on the rodeo circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And Devil's Tower off to one side. And down below is the state's legend, Wyoming, like no place on earth. And they probably should have said like no other place on earth, but...
Everybody needs an editor.
Right. It is like no other place. I can't think of another state that even comes close to being like Wyoming. It's a strange, big, empty, tough place. It is the state with the lowest population, less than 500,000 people in the entire state, spread over almost 98,000 square miles. Works out to about 4.5-5 people per square mile. And we don't really have any cities as the rest of the country would describe them. We have large towns like Casper and Cheyenne, Cody, and, of course, famous Jackson. Lots of people say when you enter Jackson, you are leaving Wyoming. It's it's not like the rest of the state, for sure. It's crammed with extremely wealthy people in some of the most gorgeous scenery in North America, with the Tetons hard at hand and Yellowstone Park just up the road. You said that we were calling ourselves the Cowboy State, and that's true. It's part of Wyoming's allegiance to the 19th century, when it really was the Cowboy State, when the place was dominated by cattlemen and big ranches.
We were talking earlier with Sherman Alexie about the state of Washington, and he spoke about that state's history of violence. You write about that a lot, too, in Wyoming, a story of violence against the Indians and then violence, riots against Chinese workers on the railroad, and most recently, I guess, the city of Laramie's reputation for homophobia in a celebrated case.
Yeah, it's interesting because Laramie's probably the least homophobic place in the state. The murder of Matthew Shepard made Laramie extremely conscious of homophobia, and I think they've done an incredible amount of work to open people's eyes to portray themselves as open-minded and willing to look at other lifestyles than a 19th century macho, totally masculine blue jeans and Stetson style.
The other thing that most people would think of in terms of Wyoming is that magnificent park, Yellowstone National Park.
Right, which, of course, is mostly within the state of Wyoming, but does not belong to Wyoming. It belongs to all of us, everybody, everywhere in the country. It is our first national park and quite an extraordinary place for people who haven't been there. It's the trip of a lifetime for sure, not to be missed.
Why do you live there?
I live here because I like the space. I like the long sight lines. I like being able to... I'm in the Medicine Bow Range of the Rockies, at the northern end of the Southern Rockies, and I'm able to get out and be on my skis, skiing madly in the winter in within 8 minutes from my front door, or in the summer hiking or fishing or all of those good things.
Annie Prue, thank you very much for being with us today, and we hope you have a great holiday tomorrow.
Thank you. You too.
Annie Prue wrote the Wyoming entry for These United States, also the author of The Shipping News. She joined us from her home in Wyoming. And let's get another caller on the line. Dale's with us from Marine City in Michigan.
Hello.
Dale, you're on the line, on the air, rather.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. I have to tell you about Michigan. It's just an unfound jewel in the United States.
Which part of Michigan? Michigan is a pretty diverse state.
It definitely is. I'm actually in Marine City, which is north and east of Detroit. I actually live on the St. Clair River, which is the river that connects the Great Lakes from the upper Great Lakes to the lower Great Lakes, which is one of the things I think is one of the beautiful things about Michigan is to be able to, in the wintertime, see a 1,200-foot freighter going up the river with an icebreaker in front of it. In the summertime, take my wave runner out with my shorts on and circumnavigate that same freighter and look dwarfed next to it.
It sounds almost idyllic.
It is. And then, you know, of course, you got Mackinac Island, which is, you know, the movie Somewhere in Time, you know, which is a beautiful, beautiful place. It's an island. They do not allow cars there. It's like going back in time. It's a wonderful place. The entire state is just a secret that just is, we like to keep it that way.
I assume they celebrate Thanksgiving in Michigan.
What's that?
I assume you celebrate Thanksgiving in Michigan.
Oh, yes, we do.
Well, have a great holiday tomorrow.
Thank you.
We appreciate the phone call, Dale.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to all of you who called and wrote on this subject. We've been talking about a series of essays called These United States, original essays by leading American writers on their state within the Union, edited and introduced by John Leonard. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.